Hello, and welcome to the Lowy Institute's Conversations, a podcast in which the Lowy Institute researchers and some of the world's leading experts delve into the big issues in international affairs. My name is Richard McGregor, a senior fellow for East Asia at the Institute. I'm joined today by Natasha Kassam, who is the director of the Public Opinion and Foreign Policy Program, along with Jane Perlez, a longtime New York Times correspondent, most recently in China, who is currently in Sydney. The subject is a research project that Natasha has been overseeing for Lowy into the Chinese-Australian community and their view on all the issues that have dominated the political debate between the two countries in recent years, from discrimination to foreign interference and the relationship itself. I want to start by asking Natasha to tell us a little bit about the research project, what is the genesis of it, and then we'll talk about the results.
Thanks so much for having me today, Richard. As you say, this is a really interesting project and one of the first of its kind in Australia. From my perspective, as the Australia-China relationship has soured, partly in response to the suggestion that the Chinese Communist Party has been looking to influence and interfere in Australian politics, we've seen much more scrutiny on Australians of Chinese background. This has only been added to by the COVID pandemic, where both governments and politicians around the world have looked to blame China for what has happened over the past year. This has had a terrible impact on some Chinese communities. Only this week, we've seen horrific spates of violence against Asian Americans. So this debate in Australia has been happening, I think, at a political level, but there have been very few voices from the affected communities. We now know there are over a million Australians of Chinese background. And so my co-author Jennifer Su and I decided to start this project that would represent and poll over 1,000 Chinese Australians to better understand their perspective on life in Australia, their relationship with China, their views on foreign influence and interference, and hopefully to insert some data into this discussion and the policy making around these issues.
So can you give us a sense of the results? You've got results on discrimination, racism, you've got results on foreign interference, and also how Chinese Australians view the various systems of government in Australia and China.
What's really interesting here is I think in Australia, Chinese Australians are often talked about as a homogenous group, but our findings really show the opposite. There is such a significant diversity in these communities and no single view. Whether we're asking about Australia, about China, or about interference, climate change, or immigration. But the broad top line here is most Chinese Australians feel a significant sense of belonging, acceptance, and pride in Australia. They say it's a good place to live. They say that they are accepted in their day-to-day life. But there is, as you say, a significant minority that have experienced discrimination of some kind in the past year. We have 30% of Chinese Australians saying they've been treated differently or unfavorably. A similar number have been called offensive names because of their Chinese heritage. And most shockingly, 18% have been physically threatened or attacked because of their Chinese heritage. When we ask about what has contributed to these experiences, the vast majority say COVID-19, and around half say the change in the bilateral relationship. On the other side of this equation, we do also see this close relationship with China. There's a lot of people who say they feel a belonging to the Chinese people and to China itself. And we can see that reflected in their views on foreign policy as well. Chinese Australians are more likely than the broader Australian population to see China as an economic partner rather than a security threat. They're more likely to support cooperation with China on aid projects or even military cooperation. But this is not the whole story. Even though Chinese Australians do express higher levels of trust in China, they also express support for sanctioning officials that are associated with human rights abuses. The vast majority of Chinese Australians say that we should diversify our economy away from China. So what we see here is a really broad variety of views, and there's just no one consistent thread. They're shaped differently depending on when these people have arrived in Australia, what countries they've immigrated from, how long they've lived here. There's just so much to unpack here.
So there's also, as you say, a strong belief and liking for Australian democracy, but also a strong respect, if that's the right word, for China's authoritarian system of government. Is that right?
You're absolutely right. And this is a debate that has played out across the world over the past year, as initially during the pandemic, there was a sense that only authoritarian systems were able to marshal the kind of strong response that was needed to deal with this pandemic. Of course, since then, we've seen that not to be the case, where countries like Australia, Taiwan, New Zealand have also managed the pandemic effectively. But we do see amongst Chinese Australians a much lower number that say democracy is the most preferable system and much more ambivalence about our political system in that sense. This does align with other academic findings that say migrants who have moved from authoritarian regimes to settle in democracies do not necessarily see democracy as the only game in town, whereas people who have always lived in that system are more likely to think that it is the only one. Having said all of that, we also can see mixed views in terms of China's system of government. When we ask Chinese Australians whether they view China's system as more or less favourable, considering its response to the pandemic, they're really divided, with 4 in 10 saying more favourable and 3 in 10 saying less favourable.
Jane, let me bring you in at the moment. You're Australian, albeit a long-time expat, which gives you an outsider's perspective. And by the way, I don't mean expat in a pejorative sense. There's a bit of that around at the moment. What is your sense of these results which you've been able to see? And is there anything there that particularly sticks out or surprises you?
I think what sticks out is the result on COVID. And that's in part because I've seen it up front here on the northern beaches where I'm staying at the moment. We have an Asian Australian friend who's a very, very successful businesswoman up here. And she was in the bank about 2 weeks ago. And a white Australian man yelled across the banking, I don't know what you call it here, banking lobby, "Go back to where you came from." And she said, "Well, I'm not Chinese, I'm Vietnamese." And he said, "Doesn't matter, you're all the same." So that's, in a way, not surprising. But what really struck our friend was that there were 5 or 6 other Australians in the lobby and nobody said a word. Nobody said anything. And I think this was really very disappointing, but also very illustrative of what's going on underneath some of these rosy numbers.
Yes, I guess the figures on discrimination aren't rosy, to be fair. 1 in 5, 18%, been physically threatened or attacked because of their Chinese heritage in the past 18 months, or as you point out, it's Asian heritage. So if we've got really 1 million Australians of Chinese heritage, it's much more than that of Asian heritage, which probably brings it up to 8 or 9% of the population. One of the other striking things that Natasha talked about was the way the Chinese-Australian view various differing systems of government. Were you surprised at that? Many Chinese-Australians actually admired or respected or believed in the current Chinese system?
Not really, because I was not surprised, because as I understand it from my younger Chinese-Australian friends, the new generation of Chinese-Australians do respect China. And they do, in turn, respect the kind of government that has brought the economic growth and the status in the world. And I don't know whether they look to the United States, but democracy hasn't done too well in the United States, which is supposed to be the flag bearer of the world as far as democracy comes. So no, I'm not surprised. And I'm also not surprised, given that the numbers on the number of Australian Chinese who listen to WeChat and get their news from WeChat, the Chinese mobile service, in either Chinese or English. So if I may say, and I don't want to be too critical, that does suggest to me that there could be more and better coverage of what's going on in China and in Asia on Australian broadcast networks across the board.
It's interesting, and actually on the day we're speaking, I think the ABC has just launched a Chinese language YouTube channel, which is interesting. But Natasha, back to you on that issue of WeChat, and I might say that this release of the polling is the first of a number of reports that Lowy is going to be producing on Chinese Australians. And you and I have actually been interviewing a lot of people face to face. What's your sense about the finding on WeChat? You've lived in China. You've got many Chinese friends here. Were you surprised at that? And is it something that the Australian government should worry about?
I would say that I'm not surprised. You know, WeChat has really become this super app in China and in many other countries where everything you do is funneled through it. So in Australia, we might think of it as an equivalent to WhatsApp, but actually it's kind of closer to WhatsApp meets Facebook, meets Twitter, meets all of our banking apps as well. So the idea of the prevalence of that app being also commonly used here in Australia, I think, is not surprising. I think where we run into issues is that WeChat is a Chinese app with very clear terms and conditions. And those terms and conditions include that the app can censor, it can take down content, it can prevent messages from being sent when they are about issues that are considered sensitive in China. Of course, we recently had our Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, put out a message to the Chinese Australian community on WeChat that was removed. And so what we're dealing with here, I think, are the broader implications of having a very significant proportion of the Australian population using an app that can be regulated by a foreign government. And at the same time, I think that Jane is absolutely right. We don't have enough foreign language content produced by Australian broadcasters. And so many of these communities, not just Chinese ones, but other migrant communities as well, are more likely to rely on places like WeChat and other foreign language providers.
Let's be honest. As you say, WeChat is the super app. I think the US talked about banning it, but of course they stepped back from that because it's not only an essential means of contact for Chinese Americans, in this case, Chinese Australians, it's also how people do business. So how does a smaller country like Australia, which does a lot of business with China, both big and small, Natasha, how do you think we manage an issue like that of dealing with a censored app, which is also essential to many things going on in Australia?
It's a really tough question, and my instinct is always going to move away from the idea of blocking or banning an app. I think that's a very blunt tool, and we have other options. But it is pretty hard in this case. One of the main issues, I think, is that most media platforms and social media companies operating in Australia in English are subject to a significant level of scrutiny and regulation. We just don't have the same capacity in foreign languages to be able to understand what is being censored, what are the terms and conditions, what kind of information is being shared, is misinformation being regulated and taken down the way that Twitter and Facebook are now being required to do. So really, I think the first thing we need to be doing is beefing up our capacity to monitor, regulate, and scrutinize in foreign languages in Australia.
Yes, interesting points. Jane, you wanted to say something there?
Yes, I think beyond going beyond the censorship and regulation, which I think is kind of the, I wouldn't look at it first that way. I would look at it this way first. I would look at it at improving the capacity in Australia on Chinese language and Chinese knowledge. And as this relationship sours, unfortunately, language capacity is declining. It should be the opposite. Chinese language capacity should be increasing so that Australia can better deal with mainland China and with the universe around it. I mean, I'm sorry to be so dark or maybe too realistic, but Australia risks finding itself this isolated country at the bottom of China's Monroe Doctrine, which some think is inevitable. And maybe if it's not inevitable, I think you still have to be prepared for it. And one way to prepare for it is to increase Chinese language in schools, in broadcast, particularly learning the language among our Australian citizens.
Jane, that is kind of putting it in a defensive sense. In other words, we might end up very China literate, but isolated anyway. Let me ask you this in the context of the broader bilateral relationship. You know, you're not rosy-eyed about China, but without apportioning blame, all the blame on Australia, has Australia mishandled this? Have we misjudged it in a way which, I guess, underscores the point you're making, that we really didn't understand the sort of country we were dealing with, or perhaps, alternatively, we understood all too well?
Look, I haven't lived here, and it's hard for me to make a decent answer on that. as a sort of an outsider who comes here from time to time, I would just say that obviously the policy is not working, because even our allies, the United States, France, Canada, New Zealand, are talking to China. How come Australia's the odd person out there? I think this is a serious question. And I think my impression is that Australia has been living too long off the tit of iron ore, if I can be crude. Australia's lived too long and had too much prosperity from China and hasn't wanted to deal with the downside of what might be coming and looking at the country more realistically.
Natasha, let me ask you about the bilateral relationship. And you obviously haven't got a data stream that you can compare the results that you've got here with what sentiment was, say, 5 years or 10 years ago. What is your sense, though, of what might have changed in attitudes amongst the Chinese-Australian community because of the deterioration of the relationship?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. And perhaps I should have mentioned earlier that we'll be running this survey for the next 3 years. So we will be able to get a sense of how these attitudes develop and change over time. But certainly through interviews, through focus groups that we've been doing amongst the community, we've really found that people are very saddened and disappointed to see the way in which the relationship has changed. They do feel like they are being seen in a different light. And when I say that, what I mean is that in the 1990s and the early 2000s, when Australia really looked to China and the economic relationship started to grow dramatically, more often than not, Chinese Australians were looked to as a way into the country, a way to understand it, to look for investment, to sell things there. And, you know, many Chinese Australians that I speak to really wanted to be in that position, and they wanted to bring their adopted country and their homeland together in that way. Over the past 5 years, we could really see that that relationship has changed, and they've gone from being potential bridges between Australia and China to national security threats in some eyes. And I think that's a really difficult position to find oneself in.
One of the most controversial aspects of the bilateral relationship in recent years has been the issue so-called of foreign interference. You know, you'll have some people argue that every country legitimately interferes in other countries through diplomacy, Israel, America, Indonesia, whatever. And they say, what's different about China? And the argument goes that the Chinese interference in recent years has gone beyond diplomacy. It's covert and coercive and sometimes corrupting. And I think there's still an ongoing debate about whether that's real or not. The Chinese Australians, can you, Natasha, describe to me the view of Chinese Australians on this? Because in theory, they're both the target of that interference and also the perpetrators of it. So they're really caught in every different way.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to put it. And I think we do see that in our findings. Again, it's a real split. So overall, there is a much lower level of concern about foreign interference from China in the Chinese Australian community. Only about a third see it as a critical threat to our interests. Having said that, even though we ask them about whether they're worried about foreign influence from a range of countries, you end up with this 50-50 sense. So 50% of Chinese Australians say they're worried about influence from China, 50% say they're not. An even smaller number say they're worried about influence from the United States. And the other thing I would say is that while most Chinese Australians do say that they believe the media and politicians are giving the issue of foreign interference too much attention, they also say the public isn't giving this issue enough attention. So I think there is a general level of concern, but it's the way in which it's being dealt with that perhaps there's more divergence in the community about.
Jane, let me ask you a question about that. You know, you've lived in the States for a long time. The US, of course, has been through its own sort of Chinese interference scandal. Some would say, in fact, they started in the early 80s with Taiwan, then the Republic of China, interfering in US domestic politics. They were the biggest lobby in Washington for some time. Then in the 1990s, we had a number of scandals surrounding the Clinton administration and various favors being done for money and the like, and a big debate in the US then at that time about whether it was a real issue or a red scare. What's your perspective on this, particularly having seen it happen in the US, where you have a much longer standing Chinese-American community in that case?
Well, I do think it's obviously, given the history, it's a very serious problem. And I think it's a serious problem in the United States and continues to be, and it's a very serious problem in Australia. And I think China has got goals and is to be expected to interfere. I think one of the problems is that this is not explained in a very mature, even-handed way, either in Australia or the United States. And I don't think it helps when incidents like the raid by ASIO on four Chinese journalists here last year happened. I mean, after it was kept quiet for a long time, and then finally it emerged. I may be getting the details slightly askew here. Correct me if I'm getting it wrong. But basically, ASIO went and raided the homes and computers of four state media journalists based here in Australia on the suspicion that they were doing things beyond journalism. And the net result was that the Chinese journalists left under orders of their government, which was to be expected. So what puzzles me is that ASIO would do such a thing, knowing that probably the results of their raid was going to be fairly minimal. I mean, what are four Chinese journalists going to do here that they, ASIO, can't know with its own sophisticated ways of spying? Why do a raid which they know is going to end in expulsion, which in turn resulted in the expulsion of the remaining Australian journalists in China, which means that Australia is without journalists of its own in China for the first time since the ABC opened its bureau in 1973. This is a very negative result, not worth the stuff on the computer of four state Chinese journalists here.
So your criticism is not of ASIO investigating these journalists, it's the way they went about it.
I think that sophisticated spy agencies leave people like that in place so they can watch them over a long period of time. Why do something that results in their expulsion right away? You no longer have access to what they're doing, and you have a very negative result for Australia as a whole, i.e. the expulsion of Australian journalists in China. It was all entirely predictable.
You and I both know, of course, and I think as you sort of alluded to there, state journalists aren't just journalists. They do have other functions.
Absolutely. We all know that. Because we know that, why not leave them in place and watch what they're doing and gather what they're doing?
Mm. Yes, it certainly had an impact on Australian journalists in China. It may have, and we don't know, of course, resulted in another form of retaliation against an Australian journalist working for Chinese state media, Cheng Lei. But as I say, we don't know the full facts of that case. Natasha, let me come back to you. I guess there's an overarching tone which this survey seeks to plumb, but an overarching tone to the debate, and it's the reason why we've been commissioned to do this research in the first place, and that is about loyalty. It's not a word anybody likes to use, but, you know, the sort of racist individual who yelled at Jane Perlez's friend in the bank on the northern beaches, the idea that Chinese Australians might be loyal to China ahead of Australia and the like. I'd like your opinion on that. Is there a sense that Chinese Australians have divided loyalties and that Beijing is trying to play on that?
So what do we know? We know that Chinese leaders for the past few years have renewed their calls to unite the vast numbers of overseas Chinese to realize the Chinese dream. That's a quote from Xi Jinping last year in October 2020. We know that much of the debate and discussion in China has been about this idea of diaspora communities facing back up to the homeland and promoting Chinese interests abroad. What happens in multicultural countries like Australia, I believe, is that the Communist Party seeks to insert itself between those diaspora communities and the societies in which they live. The issue then becomes whether the adopted country, in this case Australia, is able to kind of tolerate and even embrace that diversity. You know, we've seen Chinese Australians questioned in parliamentary hearings about their loyalty and about whether they, in fact, are willing to condemn the Chinese Communist Party. That is essentially our own government, our own people doing China's work for it, making these people feel like they'll never truly be accepted in our country. The idea of dual loyalty is a really complicated one. Like I said, Chinese Australians express a great sense of belonging to both China and to Australia. But in a multicultural country where many people are dual citizens, where half the country was either born overseas or had a parent born overseas, I think this is the kind of diversity we have to be comfortable with, we have to embrace. And we always have. And it's only, I think, I mean, always have is strong. Of course, there have been blights in our history, but I think it is of great concern that some of this messaging from China can be so successful here in Australia. And I think that's actually on us as a society, not really on Beijing.
So in a way, the attacks on loyalty, the loyalty of Chinese Australian, reinforces the message that the Chinese Communist Party itself is sending down here. Is that your point?
That is. I think, I mean, there's a really clear example. There's an Australian who's been detained in China for a number of years, Dr. Yang Hengjun. And when he released the reports to his family via consular officials, you know, he said that state security in China said to him, Australia will forget about you and not care about you because you're not white and you're Chinese. You know, your citizenship doesn't matter. We know that this is being used as a psychological game with really dire consequences.
Jane, let me ask you a related question to that, which I think does relate to our survey. It's a bit more general, but you left Australia many years ago. It's not the same country as when you left, or maybe it is. This is the point of my question. We've had vast amounts of immigration since then. It's much more multicultural, if that's the right word, or multiracial. Is it a different country or not? Has it become a different country because of that large-scale non-white immigration?
Yes, it's a different country. But I think if you scratch beneath the surface, it's not as different as we'd all like to think. And I think this anecdote I'm going to tell you perhaps illustrates it. I don't know how many people who are listening know that L.J. Hooker, the scion of Australia's real estate business, was born as Chinese. His original name was Ting Yor, and he changed the name to Hooker. And it was never known until after he died, which I'm not sure was in the 60s. He died a celebrated, amazing businessman of Australia. But he was too embarrassed to say where he came from. And okay, that's being corrected now. But I think beneath the surface, there are these old, old beliefs that come from the early legislation that we know about. I think Australia has changed a lot, but I think the government and the schools and the universities need to figure out how to work this out.
The L.J. Hooker story is absolutely amazing. One of the most recognized branded names in Australia. I'm not going to reveal my age, but I actually met him when I was a very young boy, and I remember him being famous. And I can also remember when he died, which I think, and we can't correct things on podcasts, but in the 1980s, and it was only after then that it was revealed, I think, by his family that he was of Chinese origin. As you say, in his early part of his career, he didn't dare say that. I think he probably might have later, but it was kind of too late. And so it's a really telling story. Now, Natasha, why don't you finish off? We've only got a few more minutes left. But as I said, this is the first part in a lengthy research project. Can you tell us what else the Lowy Institute is doing as part of looking into the Chinese-Australian community and related issues?
Absolutely. So as you say, this is the first report out of our Multiculturalism, Identity and Influence Project. As a part of that, we'll be looking at the relationship between WeChat and Australian elections and the way in which Australian politicians are engaging with Chinese Australian communities via that app. We'll be looking at the kind of content you can find on Chinese language media in Australia, trying to understand the way in which these publications navigate their relationships between Beijing and Australian media regulations. We'll also be talking to various organizations about Chinese community groups. We didn't get to talk about this much in the podcast, but one of the issues that has been quite significant is that Chinese Australian would-be politicians have been accused of being associated with Chinese organizations and as a result seen as somehow linked to Beijing. So we're trying to better understand what these organizations are for, what they do, how have their roles evolved over time, and what are, in fact, their ties to China. That's just some of the research that we're looking forward to putting out over the next year, Richard.
Thank you, Natasha, for that. And Natasha is speaking about the first of a series of reports the Lowy Institute will be putting out called Multiculturalism, Identity and Influence. And thanks also to Jane Perlez of the New York Times. Thank you both for joining me today.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Lowy Institute's Conversations, a podcast hosted by Institute experts with production assistance from Jennifer Reinhardt. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to joining you for the next episode of the Lowy Institute podcast, Conversations.